Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I'm a little hoarse today, nothing serious at all, probably a little allergy. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. I'm proud to be known as the conscience of psychiatry. Glad to play that role and to still be roaring and just still full of stuff as I've always been. It's October 23rd, 2019. And if you feel your question is on the target of the show, most people wait until the last show of the month, each month, and call in because they want to ask questions about their lives and questions that are particular to them. But if you have something you want to ask my guest today, 888-874-4888, 874-488. Oh my God, I'm getting tongue-tied in my old age. Now listen, this is going to be a very interesting show, a really interesting show. First, let me just check and see if David Mark Kiersey is there. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, and you sound good. You sound very, very good. Well, let me just say a few other things to my audience first. And I'm going to introduce you. Actually, it's so interesting to have you on. Folks, way back when, I was friends with David Mark Kiersey's dad, David Kiersey, who's no longer with us. And David Kiersey wrote a book, Please Understand Me, which has in it some testing. And the testing basically allows you to look at who you are. It's not for somebody else to look at and categorize you. I'd never use a test like that. But this test you take for yourself and you look at it, and it tells you something about who you are. And it gives you a profile and suggests that, you know, four categories in a profile. If you line up with other people, that might be of interest to you. And here are other people who are very different from you might be an interest. It gives you an idea about who you might be interested in being or who you already are. And one of the things that about it that fascinated me was that if I answered the questions thinking of myself as an extrovert, because I am in many ways, many of my answers fall into extrovert, or naturally, or if I think of myself more as being a little more introverted, I come out a different way. And on the extrovert end, I come out like a field marshal, general type, running things, stuff like that. And that's, of course, so much of what my reform work has been about. But if I answered a little different way, I come out as a therapist. That is, people like me are often therapists. So it's really, really interesting. And that also has to do not just with this borderline that I am between extrovert and introvert, but I also have the kind of borderline between thinking and feeling. And when I'm doing psychiatric, work on the stand or writing books, I'm heavy on the thinking. And that's when I look more like a field marshal too. But if I look about myself, how I am with my wife, the family, the people who work with me, my clients, and to some extent on the air, I'm more about feeling. And again, that's more the therapist. So this was very helpful to me. And the book, which you can get online, it was from quite a while ago. In fact, I used the first volume. Then there was a new edition. David Mark Kiersey can tell you about his father's work in that regard. But Please Understand Me. It's really, really, really helpful to some of my patients or clients and my family members over the years. I hadn't touched it much for several years, and then I started looking at it again, and a couple of my clients benefited from it, and then I got a call from this gentleman I'd never heard of, David Kiersey. He specializes in artificial intelligence. He has worked with his dad on things, and now he's keeping up his father's websites. And after he gets started, I'm going to tell you something amazing, because he sent me a clip of one of his dad's speeches from before his death. What year was his death, David?
Sorry, what was the question?
When was his death?
It was July 30th, 2013.
Yeah. And this is given shortly before his death, I think. It's a short clip about madness and how madness is a choice, but that it's ultimately driven by feeling undeserving or unworthy of attention, and I'd say love. And this is just what I'm writing about right now, and I wonder if your father and I talked about this. But so here is David Kiersey and David Mark, and I give him a warm welcome out there, and he's trying in part to make a record about his dad. And I said, well, you can do anything you want with this radio show to contribute to that record. And let's talk about your dad. Where would you like to begin?
Okay, well, I basically, I want to make kind of a record of, be able to have people know that, he was around and what his contributions are. So he obviously is fairly well known, although we never advertised the book. The interesting thing about Please Understand Me and Please Understand Me Too, which is the current version, and very popular. It was an international bestseller. It's been selling for, many millions of copies without any advertisement. So that obviously is very important in terms of his legacy. But also, he was a psychologist, a gestalt psychologist, and he worked on madness in much of his career or in the background. And so his area actually was also in that whole area of relating madness or, what he called defensive behavior with productive behavior. So everybody is productive, right, in their own personality or their what he called temperament. Okay, so he used the word temperament to talk about an individual's personality. So he goes through great detail, and you can get that in Please Understand Me Too for various reasons as a way of getting the understanding who you are or who you want to be. And but he also looked at pathological point of view. And he was in the school systems. He was a school psychologist for about 20 years, and he was sort of on the front lines of the battle between the school systems trying to corral their kids, and the kids wanting to do what they wanted to do at the time that they want. So he was fighting for individuals snared in the mental health services or community since 1950, and he was on the front lines. So he saw psychiatry started drugging people and for their normal behavior, kids being kids, or using their defensive behavior. Basically, watched the the whole area and try to understand what people do and what people say. So his methods were basically using the systems methods and understanding the looking at systems and the social field of each system. And he was considering himself the last Gestalt psychologist. And unfortunately, he's gone, and there's nobody. Nobody can recover.
Nobody can replace him. Nobody can replace him.
Yeah. So, but hopefully we can record some of this stuff. So I've been building websites and blogs with some of this stuff. He did not finally publish his book on The Dark Escape or Madness, but I've let out a few things because he wasn't happy with it. He was always tinkering with his understanding of things and always changing things. And so I'll see what I can do to disseminate some of the stuff of his madness, which is really kind of important because this whole issue of, you know, what psychiatry has been doing and the drug companies to, you know, try to help people. And then in process, as you have said many times, they're making the problem worse in many instances. So.
Yeah, your dad was very... very pleased that I was writing these books about critical of drugs. And I know he was 100% in agreement with me, but I don't think he had the time to really research it fully. And I see also from the material you sent me, the links, that he was writing a little bit about it himself, classifying drugs into the various ways they harm people. How they subdued people in their different ways, and that's so interesting to see. I mean, I think we kind of lost track of each other, in the last maybe even 10 years. And because your dad and I go back quite a ways,
right?
I'm interested in his idea. I was stunned, actually, folks. My wonderful audience, I was stunned when I listened to this 5 or 6 minute clip. And which website is that on so people can find it?
Well, that's actually
it's the one where he's sitting around talking. And you sent me the clip, and you got family noises in the background. This little boy there,
right? That actually is just there's the YouTube thing of him. We just captured it, offhand. Kind of the land, because funny thing is he didn't want, I was starting to try to get him to interview things and talk about it and things like that, and he wasn't sure, you know, he was still working on things. One thing I want to correct is he actually did the research in madness all his life. He obviously...
Oh, I didn't mean madness, I meant the drugs in particular. Did he research them his whole life?
Well, I mean, he didn't do a lot of the drugs, but he was very familiar with it because, you know, he'd watched psychiatry invade the school systems in the 50s.
Right.
And, you know, and so basically, you know, he knew a lot about drugs. Yeah, and he did.
He and I had very, very similar views to how the damaging effects of the drugs and the fact they weren't a curative of anything, basically suppressive. Right. Different aspects of human activity, mind functions, and so on. Yeah, we were very much on the same page about that. And he may have gotten in touch with me
right.
because of my books on the drugs.
Right. Exactly. Well, he, you know, obviously he had known about this problem in the 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, he obviously he was on the front lines, basically. And so he saw where they started drugging kids, you know, giving them speed, basically. And then actually in graduate school, he had watched the psychiatrists shock people, you know, and he was appalled. He was really appalled by this whole thing. Mm-hmm. They didn't ask about these individuals, right? They just said, well, you know, check the box, you know. The people that he had done some studies on had essential hypertension. And he started interviewing these people, and he realized they were normal people. And they were, you know, they're just normal people. And if you talk to them, right, they're fine. But they were a particular temperament. It was called, the temperament is called guardian. But then they were lining these people up, you know, to give them shock every week, you know, or whenever.
And what are the characteristics of the guardian?
The guardian is, they prize membership and security. So there are four temperaments, but it's basically the guardians are the majority of the population. They are, you know, that's the foundation of the civilization, right? And so basically they're important in being in membership of a community and being worrying about security. So they're about 45% of the population. Again, the thing is with these my father's model, it's the Kersey temperament model, is basically it's a model. You know, the people are not, you are not a guardian, you're not a whatever. It's just right. They're labels.
That's really true, like, folks. I mean, he's, you know, his work, Dr. Kersey's work, is very open-hearted and open-minded. He was trying to help people understand themselves by being able in some ways to compare themselves to each other. Right. And it's quite startling to have a couple in therapy or in a family, we had it in our own family, look at the various types and say, I had no idea you were thinking that way. I had no idea that you evaluated this or that in terms of your feelings, and then you had to think about it. And because I'm thinking about it, and then I feel feelings later or whatever. I am not talking, though. I'm learning with you about these four categories that I don't use. That's a little later, I guess. My familiarity is with the first book. And is this in the second book?
Yes. So he originally started, he figured out the four temperaments, basically, and he gave God names to the different temperaments, the four temperaments. But basically what he did was in the second book, he used normal words that people can relate to and kind of understand where they're coming from. So the guardian was Epimethean, which is the god of Epimetheus was the brother of Atlas, and he was sort of this foundation kind of person, right? So he called him Epimethean, but now they call them guardians. So the second,
and the kind of security, you're talking about the security of the community or their own security that are being guardians of? Tell me more, because it's new stuff for me. I think it might be interesting.
Yeah. Well, for example, you can just use examples of individuals to kind of get an idea. You know, so I mean, the standard classic one that you can think of in terms of guardians, sort of iconic. Well, you know, there are many, many, many. But let's say George Washington, right? Guardian.
Okay.
Mother Teresa, guardian. They basically, you know, serve the community. They're upstanding individuals. They, you know, and so a lot of the administrators. So there are two kinds of guardians. There are the administrators, and then the conservators. So you know, each temperament, you can also use four different kinds of guardians. And so basically you have the conservators, which are the
and this is this all comes from the basic tests, the Myers-Briggs tests.
Yeah, well basically he had discovered Myers-Briggs in the 50s, And he, of course, been working in the area of madness, right, or psychopathology, they called it, you know, fancy word for you know, people are that are not with the program, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Realized that Myers-Briggs, she had 16 kinds of types of people. And what he saw in her descriptions of the high school kids, of the 16 types, he said, oh, I can see the four temperaments. And then each temperament has four types. And so he then kind of reframed Myers-Briggs.
I gotcha. Yeah. So give me just very briefly the four basic types. We have a guardian.
Guardian, okay. That's the majority of the people in the world. They're cooperative kind of people, generally cooperative, you know, in the community, but they're also concrete. In other words, they tend to think about, places, people, and all that kind of stuff. So it's they're concrete in their thought. And whereas the artisan, which is the sort of the counter of the guardian, the artisans are, you know, everybody knows the artisans, right? You know, they are the football players, the athletes, the politicians, the people that they want to have fun. You know, they're in action. So you can.
Well, artisans, I think of people who are making things and maybe being artists, things. Not that.
Right. Yeah, no, the artisans, there are all kind of artisans, right? There's Trump, the art of the deal, right?
Yeah. Okay.
He's called a promoter artisan. You know, so there are four different kinds of promoters. There's the performer artisan, promoter artisan, the composer artisan, and the crafter artisan. So you get to all four different kinds of artisans. Basically, you know, like Michael Jordan is what's called a crafter artisan. You know, he's very good with tools and implements, you know, shoot the balls, right? That kind of stuff.
Okay. Then the politician. And what's the third one?
The third one is the idealist, which I think you are, you know. You said you're a field marshal, but again, all these are models, and you can kind of figure out what kind of where you're basically, right? So you have sort of the four temperaments. So I would call you an idealist. That's my guess, you know. Just talking to you, you know. Again, it's guess. You know, it's important the individual determine what they are. Don't have somebody else.
I imagine you're right.
Yeah,
so you certainly do sit around a lot of times trying to make the world better, right. Trying to communicate higher ideals to people. Right. I talk about that, write about that almost all day long. Go ahead.
So you were what I would call a counselor idealist, and he abandoned the Jungian notion of extrovert and introvert. He doesn't like to talk about that. He talks about your type and temperament and that kind of stuff.
So he doesn't go with, he's not particularly focused anymore when he was alive on the first book, which is the one I was so influenced by. Okay. Well, I still think it's a wonderful book, but go ahead.
We still sell, you know, we've sold millions of copies of them. And basically, some people like the first one versus the second one.
So what's the fourth type? People out in the audience are waiting to see, I don't fit those first three. What's the fourth? Okay.
The fourth is very few people fit this one. It's called the rational. And that's what I am. A rational is a guy that's interested in logic and objective. So the rational is an abstract and utilitarian person. All anyone's concerned about is, you know, does it make sense? Does it hold together? Is it logical? Does it give you cash value? You know. So one of my father's heroes was a guy named William James. And William James was a pragmatist. And basically, the rationals, they are concerned about what works. So, you know,
William James, folks, was a very great American psychologist whom I read a lot of when I was young outside of school. He had a two-volume study of psychology. I learned a lot from him. And the good thing about him is he was actually interested in the world in every way. Didn't make up all the fake psychological stuff to explain everything. Wrote a wonderful book on religion. Wrote a book called Pragmatism. Tried to be a practical philosopher. They ask, you know, what are the practical, what does this mean in practice, this philosophy of yours?
Exactly. What he's called it, the cash value. What do you get out of it? So that's what my father's, you know, his models, right? They're models. They're not, you know, you don't put people in a box. But a lot of people don't like the temperament and, you know, personality stuff. And
so who, this know, is interesting. Let me interrupt. So your dad, like me, kind of grew up somewhat on William James. Or were you just pulling that out as an example? Or was your dad very interested in him?
Yes. Well, he was extremely well-read in philosophy and psychology.
But, I mean, do you know if he was a favorite of his, William James? I still have
his books
in the bathroom sometimes to read.
Yes.
From 100 years ago or so.
Well, yeah, my father was, unfortunately, I put them all, packed them away, but basically he has a whole library of books on psychology and philosophy and other things.
I want to go now to back to what you originally started talking about, because it is something that I am so into right now, and I think could be so important. And that's, you know, why my eyes popped when I heard your dad talking about that the underlying cause of madness was feeling unworthy, I think he said, of attention. And how was he in his 90s at this point that this, he looks elderly, that this film was taken, this video?
Yeah, he was 90, so he died about a year later. So
So, because the more I'm looking at psychology, and by the way, one of the things I think about psychology, I don't talk about enough, is I think all psychology is autobiography. So if somebody has this mechanical, like Skinner, concept of human beings that they don't really make choices and they just respond to what's going on around them. I think Skinner's describing himself, and there are hints of that in his biographical materials. And if someone else, you know, says, well, it's all about learning this or that, well, they're thinking of themselves, even if they don't want to admit it. Because who could imagine a psychology that didn't fit with himself at all? It would feel a little weird. And Freud talks about sex, you know, just being the drive of that makes the world go round. I mean, and he meant sex. And then he also meant derivatives of sex. Well, I think he's talking about himself. So it's very, very important. When Adler started out in his early psychology, before you get a little more wisdom. I haven't talked about this way before, so this is very spontaneous. But when Adler talked about organ inferiority as the main thing motivating people, God knows what organ he felt inferior about, because certainly that's not what most people feel. And then later on, he got more into, you know, the difficulties of social living rather than organ inferiority and problems of superiority and inferiority, but only in a more general way about social feelings. And so I think that your dad must have been searching his own soul, as I've searched my own soul.
And that's true.
I think it's so. I'll let you in a minute. Let me finish this up. And I really believe that when I'm at my worst, I feel unworthy of being loved.
Right.
And I think that's what your dad's saying, but does he use the word love much, or does he like more abstract words or technical words?
Yeah.
Like attention?
The thing is, each of the temperaments have their own needs and wants. Okay. So, you know,
but he's not saying that in this little clip. He's saying that all madness goes back to running away from and defending against feelings of unworthiness. And I am just this instant right now writing about that. I just sent off a blog about it. It's part of a new book chapter. So I don't mean to contradict you about your own dad, but I mean, what he was saying there is that the vulnerability of humanity is feeling unworthy. And I don't think it's just he'd probably agree with me. I don't think it's just the origin of madness. I think it's the origin of all forms of despair and overwhelm. And it might help some of you listening to just think about that maybe beneath a lot of what you're suffering from, you feel unworthy of love, because that's a very practical idea. You can explore that. You can try to find out where the heck did you get an idea like that. You can find a group or people or religion that will help you with your feelings of unworthiness, a therapist, if they've got any sense. Very practical idea. Now, you were going to relate it, David, to his types.
Okay.
Saying this is a universal?
Right. The worthlessness is universal. The question is, what do you feel worthless about? Okay. So each of the temperaments have a key thing that they feel worthy about. So you can criticize somebody or praise somebody on something, and if they don't value that aspect, right, then it doesn't matter to them. So the idealists, they're interested in authenticity, okay, and if they feel inauthentic, they don't feel authentic, then they will feel worthless. Basically, they have to be truthful and that kind of stuff. They got to be truthful to themselves, and if they don't, then they feel worthless. And of course, obviously, the environment. If the environment is telling you, well, you're not worthy, right? Because you know you are not being appreciated for who you are. So that's the thing, is that it's the interaction between you as an individual, and then the environment, the social field, right? So if you don't get love or, you know, approbation or whatever you want to call it, feedback saying, well, you're worth something, then you will start doubting yourself.
This is interesting. Let me have a more free-flowing conversation with you about this. This is fascinating. Okay, I'm an idealist.
Right.
I place the highest priority on my being truthful. If I were to discuss with Ginger, you know, what it is that has always made me tick, and to a great extent Ginger, it's that I wanted to see the truth. And so if somebody said something, I always evaluated on the basis of how did that fit with the truth? Most people don't bother about that on almost everything they hear. Yeah. But I don't collapse or feel desperate if somebody doesn't say, well, I really appreciate Peter Bregan and you and so on as for your truthfulness, or I would have collapsed decades ago, because I've been speaking truth to power and they don't speak back and say, thanks, you're truthful and authentic, Petey. So I would say that, and maybe I'm not an idealist, maybe I'm something a little different, but what would throw me would be if the people nearest and dearest to me didn't think I was worthy of love. So I want you to go on now. Go ahead.
Okay.
What do the other people feel is key?
Obviously it's very complicated. So it also has to do with, you know, how are you brought up, you know, what was your environment, you know, so you're probably, in some sense, you're productive, right? The thing is, most of the time, you're productive because you feel good about yourself, right?
I'm productive whether I feel good about myself or not.
Yeah.
I think being productive helps me feel good about myself, but I'm always productive. But I always said if I could drag myself to the typewriter and I had somebody to love, I'd be fine. If I could write my truth, what I saw as to be the truth, actually not my truth, what I saw to be objectively the truth and had love, I'd be fine.
Right. Yeah, so
folks, this is rare. If you've never tuned in before, you know, this is not what you hear about usually, Peter Bregan's thoughts about himself. I'm going to find out how many people are still listening here. Go ahead.
Yeah, so let's take, I mean, there's the idealist, right? They have certain values, but they're important to them. And if their needs are not met, then they have problems. The same thing with the artisan. The artisan's another example, right? They view themselves as being graceful. And if they're not graceful, if they're not clumsy or not very good at operating things, right? Not able to manipulate people if they're a promoter or whatever, then they go to the dark side or the defensive side, okay? And so that's what, you know, they do. So the most crazy people, right, artisans, are criminals, right? They're or drug addicts or that kind of stuff. So they are the types that want to have fun, enjoy themselves, be with everybody else or be by themselves, depending on how they, what kind of person that they are.
Yeah. Now I think you misspoke. I don't think you mean that most of them are drug addicts. I think you mean most drug addicts are artisans.
But
certainly not most of that group are drug addicts.
Right. No, you can have an alcoholic guardian. You can have an alcoholic professional.
Yeah.
Things like that. I mean, the problem is.
But that's very interesting. So, and this is your father's theory that. That's the essence of what a lot of folks who are very creative and make things or fix things or play things or manipulate things, and that they're using their bodies and they ultimately treasure gracefulness.
Right. Yes.
All right. So did he actually think that if a person wasn't approved for their gracefulness, who is an artisan, that would be the direction of their madness?
Yeah.
I mean, or is this something you're putting on to it?
Yeah, in other words, he was saying you have your productive side, which, you know, vast majority of everybody is they're productive, right? We're productive in using things, right? But everybody has a defensive mechanism to be able to defend themselves from being found out as being unworthy, or shame.
He identified gracefulness as kind of the essence of the artisan.
Artisan, right, exactly.
Artisan,
right.
Sorry, artisan.
Yeah, yeah. So the artisan, you know, well, actually there are three. There's the self, unfortunately I don't have them up. I should probably get those up.
I don't want to have too much detail today, and we can come back. Tell me about the next, maybe the guardian, and what... What is the guardian's underlying need, and that they're going to get freaked out if it isn't recognized or successful or something?
Right, it's security. They're very concerned about security. That, you know, and being a member of a group. Right, they don't want to be left out. They want to be part of the community. So that they go mad if they are shunned by the community or they become depressed. So the way of people go crazy is kind of the way you can think about the different temperaments. So the artisan
does he prefer crazy? I like madness. It has a little more dignity to it, I think, and literary dignity to it.
he liked bonkers.
He liked bonkers. Okay.
Yeah, he had 100 ways of talking about, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think your dad ever went through a period of madness or psychosis or anything else desperate? Don't answer if you don't think it's appropriate.
No, he had difficulties when he was a kid because of not that he had difficulties. He just reacted to the thing, but he didn't feel good about himself because he was his parents were artisans, and his older brother was an artisan, and so he always saw himself as a very weak kind of person. Because
okay,
so in other words, what it is was his brother was 2 years older than him, and he was hard as nails, and he was an artisan, and so we would go out to football, right, and all that kind of stuff, and my father kind of saw him as weak. Himself as a weakling, but the thing is, all his friends, his cohort, were a couple of years older than he was, and he didn't compare himself. So when he got into the war and became a Marine fighter pilot, was on off the coast of Japan, he realized that he could do it. You know, he was competent. You know, so the rational there. They're what they want is to feel competent. In other words, be able to do things, be able to figure out the universe or whatever, that's what I'm my interest in is, but competence is really important to the rational.
My impression of certainly the majority of people is that they are threatened very much if they don't have community, and if they don't have security within that community. I think that that is really very, very, very true. And maybe someday on the show I'll explain why my own childhood didn't set me up like that, whatever got me focused on being the truth teller rather than the one seeking community. And yet, of course, I've done a lot of work with community, a huge amount of work with communities of various kinds, but it's not my basic nature. But I think it is most people's basic nature. I think one of the greatest threats that happens, one of the reasons why we have some difficulties in the world is that people who are in communities, like, say, the community of psychiatry, and suddenly find themselves doing a lot of harm, have a lot of difficulty saying, no, I'm not going to do that anymore, because their identity is so much about community. Right. And so that threat just is too much for them.
Yeah, they invested all their career in this certain model, the model of the medical model, right?
Yeah, but now but I'm thinking, because of what you're telling me, that there's another way to look at it. They spent all this time becoming part of the medical community.
Exactly.
I think the model is of less importance probably there. They're part of their identity. We're in a way talking about identity, right?
Right.
And their identity is the community of psychiatry. And if someone says, we're not going to invite you to our parties anymore, unless you change your theory from drugs to shock, they'll do it, or drugs to whatever. I mean, all the psychoanalysts thought of themselves, most of them thought of themselves as part of the community of psychiatry, not all. Some of them weren't psychiatrists. Right. But so when psychiatry went and said, no, we're not going to have 10% of psychoanalysts, we're all going to do drugs, they all start doing drugs, giving drugs out. I think community is not just the model of that the community has. Communities will change models.
Right. Well, in science, there is a real problem with, the fact that, that this particular model, is a new model, right? Marie Curie came up with a new way of thinking, and she was resisted all the time. And these people were, a lot of them were rationals. So, the community, man is a social social animals.
Yeah, I don't think they were so much frightened by the model as losing their community, which believed in the model. Because as soon as you step outside the model, they throw you out of the community. And it doesn't matter whether it's psychiatry.
Or science.
You know, at one point in my life, I stood in front of a conference of my fellow libertarians. I was a libertarian at the time, big national conference, and I challenged a part of the model. I said, the whole model was voluntary exchange. And I said, you know, voluntary exchange is nearly a figment of the imagination because no two people really enter in equally into an exchange. Somebody's usually got the upper hand. Right. And they get so upset that, you know, my God, I was going to ruin the community of libertarianism at the time. So what the fourth model, let's go to the fourth one. Yeah. So we've got about probably 12 minutes or so to do some more. I hope folks you're finding this interesting, that maybe it'll apply to you in some way, and maybe you'll look into David Kiersey's work, that is the dad of David Kiersey we're talking to right now.
The important
and
thing
also David's work in promoting his father. Yeah. What is the next model?
So we've done artisan, guardian, idealist, and then the rational is the competence thing. So each of the four temperaments, each of them. So, you know, as long as you're competent, that's the rational. So that was the four temperaments.
So none of the temperaments basically are wedded to loving. Am I mistaken there?
No. I mean, loving is important to everybody. The question is preference, okay? When push comes to shove, you know, what is important to you? So the thing is, again, everybody's a human. They're all common. But, you know, so, yeah, in work, where you're spending most of your time, it's important to be part of the community or not. I mean, you can have have people like me, you know, my good a person that I know very well, my ex-wife. She said, here's something reminds me of, and it says, I saw people through the window. That's enough social interaction. And that's the kind of person I am. I'm very introverted or attentive in things, and I'm not not engaged in the world as much. You know, so I'm not. You know, Einstein is not the same. You know, personality. What's important to him as opposed to somebody like Michael Jordan? You know, that they're fundamentally different in that regard. But obviously, it's a range of preference. So that's important to understand is, you know, what is your top preference, what's your second preference, what's your third preference, what's your fourth preference. So, you know, my father, his PhD was in what's called the polarization of intelligence. So the fact is that you're good at, you know, you can think of the four temperaments as four fingers. You know, you're very good. I'm very good at logical investigation. Whereas I'm terrible at logistical. So the thing is that...
So how would you rank yourself? I'll tell you how I would rank myself. I'd say that you're right. I'm first the idealist. I'm interested in the truth. Right. And then second, I'm also the rational, like you are. Right. And then I'm neither an art, really not much of an artisan. I certainly know I'm not graceful. And I'm not mostly interested in community and security, so I think I'm probably the idealist and the rational.
Right. Huh? So you would, And again, you know, one of the important things is my father talks about personality, and there's temperament and there's character. So temperament is your inborn sort of, you know, people. If you have kids, you know that the kid, you know, they're different. You know, they're different. You know, your first son and second son or your daughters, and they're different from, you know, the siblings, and they're different from your parents. So it's important to understand that, you know, that there is sort of inherent that you can't change that person. You can't change an artisan to a guardian or a guardian artisan. But again, it's preference. It's not a box. You shouldn't be thought of a box. It's more a polarity of something that there's preferences for a certain thing. And so understanding each individual's preferences is really important. And that's the advantage of using the temperaments. But also, when you're dealing with, you know, problems with society, what is the society trying to turn you into, right? Because they have they think, you know, everybody should be a guardian, right? Everybody should be play by the rules and, you know, and be part of the community and don't object to, you know, don't rock the boat.
So let me bring you back to this question I have, which is just so interesting to me, which was listening to your dad's talk, and it was only like 5 minutes long, 6 minutes long, I think, and him sitting there with the family and saying that madness is a choice, he said, which is interesting too. I wrote a paper decades ago, 1980, I think, something like that madness is a failure of free will. But I've modified that. I think that's people don't experience that as what's going on. I think madness is more being robbed of your free will, being caved in. And it isn't necessarily so that somebody always has a choice about it, because under some conditions, anybody could be caved in. So I don't emphasize the choice so much anymore. That was one of my points about me and your dad, but so similar again, thinking about the same issues. And the other one is that I still don't get where his talk, where he talks about madness being a flight from or a defense against feeling unworthy, and in particular of attention. Maybe he wasn't thinking about love. Maybe he was thinking about these other things, unworthy of being appreciated for gracefulness or authenticity or security or competence. Right. I mean, help us all out with this. I think it's important.
Each person has what it's important to them. So, yeah, they're different. They're different. So
it's not universal like I thought I was getting from him.
Yeah, the universal is that madness is defensive. That is, we use techniques that appear mad to hide the fact that we feel unworthy, and we're hiding from ourselves, and it's unconscious. It's a hidden gain, okay? A hidden gain to ward off the feeling unworthiness. What you feel unworthy about is different for each of the temperaments, and depending on your character and your temperament. So,
well, listen, my wonderful audience, I would love some of you to send me a little email at my dedicated line for the radio show, breganlive@hotmail.com, breganlive@hotmail.com. And what do you think about this? Do you think, as I do, that being unworthy of love is what really drives us out of our minds? What really, and we can go out of our minds into depression, anxiety, despair, psycho, whatever. Right. But that it's really what caves us in ultimately, because in my notion about it is that it goes back to infancy, where love, nurturing, caring was the absolute essential quality that people needed. Of course, they didn't want to starve to death, they didn't want to die of a terrible illness, but the fundamental social relationship issue was the love and nurturing from mother. And that when we re-experience those moments that we all had of being, feeling unworthy in relation to the love in the family, that if that gets re-stimulated, and if we had an awful lot of feelings like that, that is what ultimately caves us in. So let me know if you think that's on target, or do you think we're not even close to anything here, or do you think it's multiple feelings of unworthiness in different ways, not just of love? Right. Is that a clear statement, David Kiersey, from your viewpoint?
Yeah, that one more
formula.
Unworthiness, you know, it depends on the individual. But yeah, everybody wants to feel valued, right? If we don't feel valued, then we question our worthiness.
But see, there's where they're so interesting. But there's where we look at value. That's so interesting because valued gets pretty close to being loved. So
valued. You know, it depends on how you value it, right? So, you know, obviously there are different kinds of loves, right? There is the love of a brother, love of a son, the love of a mother, love of a friend, love of a, you know.
Oh, I think that what makes us go over the hill is when the small child in us isn't loved, but as in a mother. That's just as in childhood, that will destroy a child if they do not feel a love connection, a bond. This is attachment theory, folks. You want to find the marvelous psychologists who've talked about this. It's Bowlby.
I would say it's a lot more complicated than that. You know, attachment.
Yeah. I get that. And I'm going for the simple here, and you think it's much more complicated. And I think that's a very valid approaches to think about, and if you want to participate in having a little say about it, folks, let me hear from you at BreganLive@hotmail.com. And remember, all these shows are archived. And next week, I'm going to have an amazing announcement for you about what we're going to be doing with the show in the future. It is something enormous about how you're going to be able to experience the show. I'm going to leave it at that and tease you. It's in the works with the great people at PRN FM. And it's very exciting, and I'll be talking to you about it. And don't forget to go to my frequent alerts at www.bregan.com. They're free. You can keep up with me. Do you have a 30-second thought to leave folks with?
Well, basically, I think if people are interested, they should check out my father's books on, you know, Please Understand Me Too. If you're interested in the madness stuff, unfortunately, that not everything's in one place, but there's obviously personality. There's the Kierzy.com website. That's
Kierzy.com is, and spell that for folks.
That's KEIRSEY.com. So that's professional. That's more business aspect to it. The madness stuff is kind of on a soft side. So there's ProfessorKierzy.org, which is my website.
Is that the best one for madness?
Madness, I think, is probably the best. There's a history of madness, and it's more, you know, it's much more academic. It's more, you know, more non-details. ProfessorKierzy.wordpress.com. And so
ProfessorKierzy.wordpress.com.
And of course, you can obviously.
No, I didn't hear it.
Google.
.com?
ProfessorKierzy.wordpress.com.
Oh, .wordpress.com for the madness stuff.
And then you just look up David Kierzy.
That's the music in the background that pretty soon they're going to drag us by my neck off the show.
Okay, sounds good.
It's been wonderful, David, to have you on. Thank you for popping up in my life, and I hope you're pleased to have popped me up in yours. And folks, this was a very interesting show for me. I hope it was for you too. And I'll be seeing you next week. I hope everybody on the radio, and then there's going to be interesting alternatives. Thanks a lot for listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan out. Bye-bye.